Well, we're glad your radio is on, and a good morning to you folks. Want to say happy birthday to Bob Mullins, one of the board members here at the King of Kings Radio Network, turned number 90 today. And a good morning to him. We have a special guest with us online, and yesterday I heard his conversation with Jim at VCY America, and I've asked him to join us today. Let me greet Matt Staver of Liberty Council. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. We listen to you every day with Faith and Freedom and Freedom's Call, and you just load us down with information. Yesterday, Matt, you were talking to Jim at VCY America on the State of the Nation in reference to the coronavirus, and it has a lot of people worried. It particularly involves the elderly and those compromised with health situations. And it's easy to fear. How about just telling us, the state right now of everybody, how concerned are you and so on?
Well, I have no concern at all about the coronavirus. I've, like a lot of people, have done a lot of research on this and compared it to numbers. I've read a lot of other medical analyses of the coronavirus. Frankly, I have no concern about the coronavirus. I am, however, gravely concerned about particularly government leaders' reaction to it, because my concern is that the extreme reactions to the coronavirus do not match the threat. You know, it's kind of like a fight, and you have self-defense. In the law, self-defense has to meet the level of aggression. If you exceed that level of aggression through self-defense, then you become the aggressor. And so you balance it. Did that person's self-defense ultimately equate to enough, not more, ultimate defense to repel the aggressor? That's any kind of threat that we have. The question is, what's the response? Is it commensurate with the threat that we face? And when we look at the coronavirus, comparing it against everything else, and some people say, well, don't compare it to the flu. And I understand that there's similarities. I understand that there's differences, so don't get me wrong on this. But when you just look at the raw numbers of the annual flu, the influenza, and that's just one of many things that you look at. You look at other situations such as SARS and MERS and all the other viruses that we've had recently in the past decade or two, and you do all the numbers. And in this respect, if you look at the annual influenza, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has data. Right now, we are in a low flu season, and that low flu season results in 18,000 deaths around the country. That's flu season runs from October to March. That's roughly, let's just say, 180 days, so half of the year is flu season. The peak generally for most of the past 36 years has been in February, not always. It could be December, it could be January, it could be March. It varies, but most often than not, it peaks in February. Well, this is a low flu season. The 18,000 deaths is low. When you go back 2 years ago, we had 34,000 deaths. We had 500,000 people in the hospital. I'm not talking about going to an outpatient or a doctor. I'm talking about hospitalizations, 500,000 people. One in five Americans, or 34,000 people died. 55 million Americans were infected. That's one in five Americans were infected. And the ones that are at risk are the same ones that are at risk now to some extent. It's usually young and old, and those that have other respiratory or other predisposed weakened immune systems. And the coronavirus, it's not the young. It's not these children under 10 years of age, unlike the influenza. It is the older population that have some predisposition, respiratory conditions, weakened conditions, and so forth. You know, take a look at Florida as an example, the state in which I live. There are 67 counties in Florida. 25 of those counties have someone that's tested positive. The county in which I live has six people that have tested positive. The first one was an individual from a Nile cruise in Egypt, and that's where he got it. He didn't get it in Florida, and he came back, and he tested positive. No one has died in Seminole County. And yet the governor yesterday issued this directive through an executive order that restaurants should go to 50% occupancy. You should have tables staggered 10 feet apart from each other. And we're talking about, and so yesterday, one of the restaurants nearby to us, the management just closed down because people were so afraid they didn't come. And that means the managers get zero income as of yesterday. And we have four or six cases in the entire county. The numbers just don't match up. You know, only one-third of the counties in all of Florida have one or more persons affected. Only two counties, South Florida, Broward and Palm Beach counties, have the majority of all of it in the population state of 18 million. So when you look at these numbers, these excessive restrictions that we have, that we're seeing, including numbers on assembly. You know, it started off, David, with 250. Where do they get that? It just pulls it out of the thin air. Then it went down to 100. Now it's 50. Some are even saying now 10 and even limit your meetings in your home to 10. And that is what happens to the churches. The churches have been closing their doors. And what has happened historically is the church has run to the danger, run to the people that needed help with plagues throughout history. And now the churches are being closed down. Some of them are doing it voluntarily. Others now are living in states where these enormous powers that come from these state emergencies, state of emergency declarations in the states and even the local governments, have these enormous powers that have not been tested. Some of these enormous powers actually allow governments, for example, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, to seize private property, to literally take over private businesses. These have never been tested constitutionally. We've always had these kinds of things on the books. They've been used in cases of hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, or fires, mudslides, whatever you might have. And it hasn't gotten out of control. But I'm telling you, what we're seeing now is absolutely disturbing to no end, the precedent that's being set. Under these conditions, my goodness, what is going to happen? What's the end game? And finally, what's the precedent we're going to actually be setting when something more serious and pervasive comes upon us, as it has in the past? I mean, this is not the most pervasive or most life-threatening kind of condition. If you look at the numbers so far, 80% of the people who are infected, they resolve without medical treatment. Of those, 15 to 20% have some kind of medical treatment. So that is at most 20% of those affected. You never hear about the 80% that resolve with no medical treatment. You never hear about those good reports. You only hear about the 15 to 20%. Of the 15 to 20%, it can be some kind of medical treatment, could be hospitalization, and could be, in the rarer cases, the severe situations, including death. But, you know, put that in perspective, and put it in perspective of how many people every year are impacted by the flu, how many people were impacted by the H1N1, the SARS and MERS virus that happened, the people that died. We didn't have these kinds of severe panic restrictions, a panic and then restrictions because of the panic. So those are concerns, David, that I have. I think that the reaction, the panic, is not commensurate. I think it's excessive in light of the actual data that we have of the coronavirus.
Well, that brings me to a question, a couple of questions here. You have the New York governor, and then you have the Virginia governor, now Kentucky governor, is ready to call out the National Guard. That's the latest word. And how concerned should we be about martial law? What does that mean? And how let's see, extreme is a possible governor dictatorship.
It's very extreme, and this is not a stretch of the imagination. When you look at what's on the books for these different states, it's very concerning. Like, for example, let's look at North Carolina. North Carolina has imposed, just by executive order, and this is just a governor signing something. This is not the legislature passing a law. It's not debated. People in the community don't know anything about it. They just get an executive order, and it gets announced during a press conference. Well, this one says it's going to ban, at the time, it was 100 persons. Now he's lowered it to 50. So he says no mass gatherings of 100 persons or more in a single room or a single space at the same time, such as an auditorium, stadium, arena, large conference room, meeting hall, theater, or any other confined indoor or outdoor space. It includes parades, fairs, and festivals. It goes on to say a mass gathering does not, now he may have changed it since then, does not include normal operations at airports, bus and train stations, medical facilities, libraries, shopping malls and centers, or other spaces where more than 100 persons are gathered. It also does not include office environments, restaurants, factories, grocery stores, or other retail establishments. Now, he's probably added restaurants in there now. But guess what's not exempted? Churches, houses of worship. So all, you know, you can have a library, but not a house of worship. You go over to Virginia, and this is what's in the state law. It says that the Board of Health may promulgate regulations and orders to meet any emergency or to prevent a potential emergency caused by a disease dangerous to the public. It goes on to state later in the law that the state health commissioner shall have the authority to require quarantine, isolation, immunization, decontamination, or treatment of any individual or group of individuals when he determines that any such measures to be necessary to control the spread of any disease. And it continues on. The health commissioner, in concert with the governor, shall be authorized to require the use of any public or private property, building, or facility to implement any order of quarantine or order of isolation. A mayor in Champaign, Illinois, just signed an executive order. Now, she says she's not going to use the power, but the power gives her in that city. We're not talking about the state. We're talking about the city now. State has its own. Now you got the city, and that gives her the power to ban the sale of firearms or ammunition. Now, she says she's not going to use it, but that's the immense power that these state of emergencies create. On the federal government level, you know, President Trump issued a state of emergency. It doesn't have the kind of impact that the states do. The real problems come down from the states. The federal government state of emergency allows the president and the administration to cut through bureaucratic red tape, to speed up things, and to provide funding. It's not going to impose restrictions from the federal government position. But it's the states and then the local governments that have this enormous power. None of this, David, none of it has ever been tested in the courts. There is a provision in the Constitution. It's rarely been used. We litigated this some years ago in the context of the Republican form of government. I'm talking about Republicans or Democrats. I'm talking about the representative form of government that we have set up in the state and federal constitutions with three levels of system: executive, legislative, and judiciary. We raised that in one of the context of the same-sex marriage cases some years ago up in the Northeast. It has been rarely used. The court said it doesn't apply in that case. It wasn't as extreme as necessary. It said, but it may apply in the context of martial law. When martial law allows under these state or local provisions, a governor or a mayor to act like a dictator. That is a complete destruction and abolition of the Republican form of government set up in the Constitution, which guarantees that we have a Republican form of government throughout the country. and that is this representative tripartite level of government between the three branches. It is designed specifically to prevent someone from exercising dictatorial powers. Now, that has never been used to question this martial law because we've never had anything like this. But I'm telling you, what is very concerning is there are people talking about this. Governor of New York's asking President Trump to federalize different private businesses, to literally take them over. I mean, you're talking about what we've seen in Venezuela and other communist repressive regimes where they literally take over people's private property, private homes, and use it for government use. That is something that these state and local laws give power, but it's never been tested. And the test would come under the Constitution of the United States that guarantees, under all circumstances, even under martial law, that we maintain a Republican form of government.
Well, it's very alarming, and it continues to be. Now, here's another situation that you don't hear too much said about it, is that 80% of our antibiotics are made in China, 65% right. are industry sales. That includes blood pressure, Parkinson, epilepsy, depression, penicillin. And it is said that China could potentially weaponize our medicines. They can sell us medicines without any medicines, and they sell us medicines that have lethal ingredients in them. Are we at war?
Well, you know, up until President Trump, no president, no administration, members of Congress were not willing to challenge China. It's been a big mistake, and they've become more and more powerful. Companies have looked at profit, and, you know, you're talking about Nike. You're even talking about Hobby Lobby. You go there, everything in their store is from China. They're looking at profit-making motives to operate in China. You have to give over your intellectual property. So they then make knockoffs of our goods. They import things to us. I know that they actually try to avoid import taxes by mislabeling items as something that is of a lower value than actually it is. China's been a real problem from the get-go. And if you look back at China, it's not just this disease that has originated in China. It's previous other diseases also originated in China and then infected the world. SARS was a disease that came out of China as well. And, you know, I have no doubt that China was probably experimenting in biological warfare, and ultimately this thing got released. I don't know. You know, we may never know that. But China has been a real big problem. I think we are at a Cold War, if you will, with China, at least in the sense of we obviously have diplomatic relations with China, but I'm talking about in a strategic sense. If we don't take China seriously and start making things in America and not purchase from these companies or stores that make their profit off of China, and that's going to be hard. I'm telling you, it's hard. But, you know, we've created federal regulations and taxation that ultimately has, in a sense, forced many of these corporations to go to China or go offshore because of the hostile tax system and bureaucratic regulations that we have in the United States. President Trump has been trying to cut through all of that to bring jobs back. That is a serious thing that we need to continue to do. We need to bring companies back in America. We need to do production back in America, the medications, pharmaceutical companies, all of those things need to come back in this country, because the more we rely or outsource to China or import from China, the greater vulnerability that we have. And we see that China is no friend of anyone else. This virus started in China. Why are we having some of these reactions? It's because this virus started in China, and they continued to remain silent. They wouldn't let people know some of the data for some time. They wanted to keep it under wraps, and finally they couldn't. And now it's impacted the entire globe.
Well, that brings me to another question. What are the possibilities if a governor issues, let's say no more than 10, no more than 20 at a public place, and a person does not honor that, what are the possibilities of jail and stuff like that? Is that a possibility?
Oh, that is a possibility under these laws that are currently in effect on these different states. And, of course, it's going to be a difference from state by state. There are prosecutions that are possible. There's in one state there was a misdemeanor of the second degree that is possible. There's different kinds of penalties that are possible. There's arrest that are possible. I mean, even in, for example, Israel, I mean, you might say, well, you know, we saw these images happening in China where these police in hazmat suits were forcibly taking people from their homes into quarantine. That's China. But that just recently happened in Tel Aviv in Israel, where a man violated his quarantine. He went outside in Tel Aviv, the big city in Israel, and the police in hazmat suits wrestled him to the ground and took him away. The U.S. government right now, Israel and Taiwan are tracking people that are in quarantine with their cell phone technology. The U.S. government right now is talking to technology companies, including Facebook, about being able to track people using this cell phone and other kinds of technology to find out where they are. This could include people who are under quarantine or where they have been. So, you know, the violation of personal privacy, the justification that is being used of fear to violate personal privacy is very concerning. And the consequences, again, they haven't been challenged, but in some cases I'm sure they may well be challenged, are arrest and jail under these exceptionally broad laws that are currently on the books of these different states and local governments under the condition called a state of emergency, which they've declared.
Well, I contacted Fox News yesterday and told them that I was concerned about the silence of pastors. They've been talking about this coronavirus and not including the shepherds of the community. Why are the pastors so silent about this? Is fear and ignorance a part of that?
I think, well, you know, I don't, obviously there's pastors that are very strong, but there's other pastors that are silent. And I saw early on, when these restrictions of 250 came up, even when they were recommendations, pastors were willing to comply with that. These were not mandated at the time. They were just willing to shut it down and go virtual. I think that was a mistake. When the government can set 250, it can set 150 or 10. You know, they can just set any number they want to. But pastors need to be speaking out, whether they're holding service or not. And that's an issue that, you know, they're going to have to deal with in their states, especially under these executive orders that now have potential prosecution and criminal penalties. I think in some cases, like North Carolina, you know, that is clearly unconstitutional to allow people to meet in a library but not in a worship service. I think that's unconstitutional. There's no constitutional rational basis for that kind of restriction between secular and a private meeting. I get it with regards to the medical hospitals and so forth, but a public library? No, I don't see that. I think it's very discriminatory. So I think pastors need to be speaking out. You know, if you go back in history, it's the church that spoke out, and it's the church that ministered. It's the church of Jesus Christ that ran to danger, ran into the areas of plagues. If you go back and look at some of the plagues during the Roman period, a couple of different times, even some of the emperors were succumbed to and died because of some of the plagues. The Christians went to the people, the Romans in the Roman Empire, to provide a ministry, and they did not concern their own life. They were more concerned about the safety and the eternal destiny of the people that they were ministering to. I think right now that pastors and churches, Christians of every place, no matter whether you're a pastor or a church leader, need to be light, need to project hope. I encourage you to go to do an internet search for Jesus's words regarding fear, or just fear in the Bible. It is filled, both Old and New Testament, and many times from the mouth of Jesus, he's telling people, the disciples, those around him, don't be afraid. you know, no matter what it is, calming the wind, calming the waves, healing the people who are lepers that people would shun, healing exceptionally high fevers with a word. We need to provide hope, and we need to convey the message of peace, all is well, and we need to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ.
Mm. I appreciate that, Matt. I think that's good, tremendous counsel. I want to ask about freedom of speech. Where does it play in this hyped situation?
Well, freedom of speech, I think, is, you know, the problem that we're seeing on Facebook is that they're literally censoring things off Facebook. A pastor friend of mine just posted recently from Texas that he said there's good news. Tom Hanks and his wife, you know, are recovering from the coronavirus that they contracted in Australia. Facebook deleted it, said it was against community standards. They eventually put it back on. But another one that they didn't put back on, he said that his church was going to continue to meet, but it was going to do it virtually. They literally wiped that out. He's got a screenshot of it, said that this post violates their community standards. I mean, it's unbelievable, the restrictions in the social media that's happening. But so far the government has not restricted individuals' free speech. They're certainly restricting individuals' freedom of religion and freedom of assembly right now. And I don't know if people will ultimately challenge these. Some people just seem to be content, and they push back on some of these restrictions, but then some people kind of give up and say, well, they must know something more than we do. Whoever they are, know more than we do. They ought to tell us. Right now, the information that's out there for anybody to research does not match up with the kind of severe reaction, panic, restrictions, and hysteria that we're seeing. So to all those who are listening, I encourage you to not get scared. We have to remember, we serve the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. He created everything. We need to use this time to pray, and we need to use this time to support ministries, because they're going to be impacted as well, to support our community, support people around us, and to pray that this ultimately comes to nothing, and that this panic and hysteria, just simply in the name of Jesus, is gone, and that we need to, in our social media, in our postings, in our communication with friends, we need to speak the healing words of Jesus, which he said, "Fear not, little flock."
Matt, it's been a privilege to have you. I have one other question that concerns me. What about the pastor that says, I don't feel like I need to shut down, I'm going to have regular services? And let's say he has 250 people to show up. Let's say that he is challenged with an arrest or a threat, and the news media makes him look foolish. How would you respond to that?
Well, you know, I would say that the news media certainly will try to make you look foolish. You know, there are some people that even say, well, this one group over in China, some people call it a cult. I don't know enough about that particular group to say one way or another, that they were responsible because they kept on meeting. And, you know, that's one, and who knows, because that has had a lot of criticism before. I can see that this is a way for the media to ultimately target churches and Christians to place the blame on them. I mean, even, for example, an MSNBC commentator said that President Trump ought to be prosecuted for negligent homicide. I mean, it's absolute insanity. So we don't live or die by virtue of whether we get good press, bad press. You know, we don't serve an answer to the New York Times or CNN or MSNBC. We serve a risen Lord, and that's who we ultimately are accountable to. That's who died for us. That's who's given us a life beyond this virus and life beyond this body. And I would say, have no fear. Go forth. This is what true believers have done throughout history. They've been unafraid in the face of danger, and they've continued to shine the light of Jesus Christ.
Matt, thank you. Thank you for your ministry, and your counsel has been warming today, and we'll talk to you later. God bless.
Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.
Okay, Matt Staver, Liberty Counsel, and I don't want to quit right now. I know we have Dr. Stanley coming up, but maybe you have a question that or comment you want to make. I think we need to talk about this. I tell you, he dealt with a number of things. If you'd like to have a copy of this conversation, you're welcome to it. And share it with your congregation. And, you know, I like what he said. When there were problems and troubles, the church ran to the problem, ran to the troubles to offer some kind of solution. We'll give you an opportunity to sound off here at 800-408-8888, 679-1342. Like to hear from the pastors if we possibly can. And then we'll join Dr. Charles Stanley. Love to hear from you. 800-408-8888, 679-1342.
I shall not be moved. Standing on the cornerstone, I shall not be moved. Standing by faith, looking forward to the day Jesus comes to rapture the church away.